The great religious teachings of the world emerge out of the actual realization of one's own religiousness, one's own communion with transcendence itself. And these teachings come into being in terms of thought and speech for the purpose of communication. That communication is made in the thought modes and the common speech prevalent at that time for those people with their particular culture, development, heritage, and so on. Because the teaching is so near the reality of the experience, and it has such a powerful inspirational influence, it lives for centuries. But remember that what comes down to us is the form, the words, and the interpretation of those words and those ideas, the content of the mind which stands behind those words, belongs to that age and for those people at their level of development. This is a very important point to bear in mind. When it comes down to us across so many centuries, a tremendous change has taken place in the meanwhile. Our thought modes and our modes of communication have undergone very great change, primarily due to the fact that our knowledge of the nature of things, in other words, science, mathematics, and so on, has undergone a very great change. According to the change in our knowledge of the physical world, there is a changed mode of interpretation of all expressions in language. So it is very easy to misinterpret the past. It is also equally easy to reinterpret in the light of modern knowledge and to express in modern terms that which was realized in the past, provided we ourselves have in some degree or other touched the reality of transcendence. I should put it the other way around. So long as we ourselves have been touched by transcendence. Now, you see, when that happens, and the new expressions come out, the world of scholarship immediately feels that, oh, this argument as to what is the true meaning is never going to end, and so forth. But the true meaning of the truth of religion, which is a realized transcendence, is something which utterly defies words, whatsoever the words are. There is no way of penetrating into those inner depths excepting by personal realization. This is where religion, in its inner reality, is so utterly different from science, art, philosophy, and all the rest of it. This is something which those of us who are deeply concerned with religion must appreciate. Simple.
Thank you.
Now, I've said these words as an introduction to what may be rather helpful for us to look into rather deeply. We talked a little bit about karma last time. And you remember I said that all those forces which have influenced us from without or from within are embedded in the psyche. And it is those forces which actually constitute the source of all that happens in our lifetime. The pattern of our life emerges in accordance with those forces. But now, be very careful in understanding this. Those forces embedded in the psyche are not dead things. They themselves are living. They themselves are undergoing constant change, as the organism itself is undergoing constant change. And so the pattern which emerges has no element of a rigid determinism about it. There is very considerable elasticity. And the person who is intelligent can influence that pattern from moment to moment. They are not dead forces, they are living forces. The living forces within a living organism, changing in a living manner. Now, there are not many people who can really look into that and see it clearly. They think of karma as a fixed, rigid law, like law which is all embodied in the books. Turn to page 492, section 3, 1926 Act, so and so, and you will find exactly what the law is. And that has to work out like that forever and ever, amen, so to say. It's not at all like that. It has no relationship to that. Nor is karma, therefore, a seesaw equilibration in life. A person did this, therefore this will be the consequence to him. This is a hopelessly wrong presentation of karma, a total misunderstanding, in fact. Look at the word itself. Karma is derived from the root kri, which means to create. Karma also means action as a secondary meaning. But the action which is karma in the true sense is action which is creation. And creation means, implies necessarily, creative power. The two are not different. It is not as if here is creative power which produces creation. Creative power and creation are one and the same thing. They are an identity. There is no meaning to creation apart from creative power. And there is no meaning to creative power apart from creation itself. Creative power does not function in terms of time. It functions in eternity. It is we who apprehend creation as a time process. Because we can't see the thing in its wholeness. Actually, there is continuous creation because there is creative power. And this brings about the totality of manifestation. Creative power, therefore, has no consequence to it. That which functions in eternity, which is of the nature of immortality itself, is free of all causation as we define causation, cause and effect. A limited context with certain finite energies at work, in course of time giving rise to another limited context with finite results manifested. That is not it at all. Karma in its totality, in its wholeness, is an absolute thing. Not a static absolute, a dynamic absolute. Continuous creation, this creative power at work. When transcendence is realized through you, the individual, because you are utterly purified, utterly transparent, unresisting to the whole reality, when that happens, causation has vanished for you. Try and allocate cause and effect with regard to anything that transpires, even in the limited context in our life. You will never be able to lay hold of the whole cause. You can't. Because there is only one creative power manifest as creation, which includes everything that we, because of our short-sightedness, see in little bits. So you see, this word karma seen with short vision by the intellect has been misunderstood through the ages. It was convenient in the old days to talk about it for communication purposes in terms of cause and effect. But the totality is not subject to time. The totality is in eternity. And succession does not apply to totality. And if that is the case, and that is the case, the common garden corollary which is added to karma in the shape, the form of reincarnation is also false. Quite false. The old people used the word punarbhava, again becoming, as it is translated. That's about the best translation we can give. Hindu teachings, I would say unfortunately, also used the term punarjanma. Now the word janma means birth, and primarily in the sense of a new person being born out of its mother. You see, birth in that sense. So of course, punarjanma inevitably gives rise to the idea of a reincarnation. But the Buddhist formulation is nearer the reality when it talks only of Punarbhava, or as in Pali, Punarbhava. That is much nearer the truth. How should we today understand Punarbhava? They said again becoming. That's the literal meaning of Punarbhava. But in those days, their knowledge of the nature of things was very inadequate as compared with our modern knowledge. Actually, Punarbhava is the emergent process. What is this emergent process? What emerges out of what? It is only another way of talking of the changing totality as far as manifestation is concerned. There is a continuous transformation taking place within this totality. And this transformation is the again becoming. But the word again is slightly misleading. Because the moment you use the word again, you are tied up with time. This time, and this time, and this time, and this time, and this and that are called again becomings in time. And why is that hopelessly wrong? We are conscious of time unidirectionally. We have only a linear consciousness of time. But is time linear only? We are conditioned by a little, in modern times particularly, we are conditioned by a little instrument which keeps saying tick tock with monotonous regularity. And our concept of time is just that. The concept which we form. But our living experience is not the slave of time. Our living experience is a rhythm of life. And a rhythm of life is non-directional. This rhythm belongs to eternity, not to time. Time is a mechanical contrivance. We have no sense of time as living organisms in actual fact. We have only a rhythmic sense in us. But the conditions of life and this invention of the clock and so on have so conditioned us that the concept of time, a mechanical rigid concept, has emerged, and well, you know how we are the slaves of time. Got to be here by 4 o'clock in order to get a good seat. So you see, this again becoming as a process in time, yesterday, today, tomorrow, and so forth, is a mistaken way of understanding the reality of Punarbhava, which is this rhythmic process. And the marvelous thing about the rhythm is that it is always a new creation. This is very difficult to see. Intellectually it is possible to see it, but it is only the perfected yogi who can actually experience it, because it takes place with such incredible rapidity. It is the life-death rhythm which goes on instantaneously all the time with tremendous rapidity. You know how if you get a When an electric bulb, for instance, is about to give way, what seems a steady light suddenly quivers like that, doesn't it? At a very great speed. It is this sort of thing which is the rhythm of life. It's the rhythm of life-death. But death for us means, in the ordinary way, an extinction. A disruption, a disintegration, or an extinction of continuity. But death in its reality is only other life. Not an other life for this which is alive here and now. Do be careful about that. Otherwise we are back in the pit of reincarnation. We ourselves are beings, as we say. In actuality, we are simultaneously being and non-being. This is the actuality. And this rhythmic vibration, being non-being, being non-being, with incredible speed, is the life-death rhythm. Life, other life, life, other life, life, other life. The manifested into the unmanifested into the manifested, and so forth. But every time that happens, every single complete vibration is creation, and that is new. Creative power is wholly non-repetitive. This is something which is not easy to see. It is really very difficult. You know why? Simply because our senses are so slow in their functioning. They can't keep pace with this tremendous universal rhythm. We use phrases like, oh, we live in eternity and so forth. We don't know what we are talking about. But when we do begin to see what we are talking about, then the whole of life completely changes. I don't mean the external shape of life, but this inner awareness of life and livingness undergoes a total transformation. And it is that which marks the birth of the new man within one. So now you see, this corollary which is added on to the old-fashioned presentation of karma, this corollary is not reincarnation, but this again becoming, which is actually an emergent process, which is the rhythm of life in constant manifestation. Try and be free of the feeling that, oh, this is abstruse metaphysics or some such thing. There's nothing abstruse about it. It's very simple, really. You can all dance with the body. Dance with the spirit. And this exactly is the thing that will happen, which I've been talking about. It's the dance of eternity. The universal process may be described physically as the ring dance of the atoms from the beginning. Bad word to use. But the everlasting ring dance of the atoms. But coupled with that, there is this marvelous ring dance of the spirit. The atoms are innumerable. The spirit is one. The atoms can come and go. The spirit never comes, never goes, is never born, never dies, as Arjuna said. I mean, as Sri Krishna said to Arjuna. But you've got to feel this rhythm. And you'll feel it in the quietude of mind. When you're free of the fears associated with misconceptions about karma. Now, how do these forces which are embedded in the psyche come about? First, we use this word psyche, and we use the word mind. I've spoken about this last meeting too, you remember, a certain amount. But it is so important that it is worth our while clarifying our ideas more and more. The psyche has its roots in the body itself. Brain, nerves, ductless glands, blood are the more important elements which form, which comprise the roots of the psyche. No body, no psyche. But mind, in the sense of pure mind, mind only, which is the one, which is one universal reality, just as space or the scientist's energy is one fundamental universal reality, undifferentiated. Similarly, pure mind is just one undifferentiated universal reality. But psyche is personal to you. It depends upon your body. And the way the psychical life goes is very considerably determined by all the physical factors involved, with heredity, with external circumstance, with the prevailing way of life around you. It also depends upon all the conditioning of our psycho-cultural, of our socio-cultural heritage. All that conditioning. Because that conditions the way we think and the way we believe. And that conditions our actions. And our actions in turn condition the state of the body. What we eat and drink and how much rest we take and how much exercise we take and all the rest of it. See? There's a very complex process going on like that. And therefore, each person's psyche is individual to that person. That's one aspect of psyche. But it is important to understand that the roots of the psyche lie in the body itself. Material. That is the clay out of which the rose bush of the psyche emerges. There is this other force, pure mind, this transcendent universal energy, the energy that cannot be measured, like electrical or heat energy or any other energy can be measured. This functions through every living individual. And because he has brain, and because he has psyche, therefore, this energy influences psyche in ways which are not apparent, usually not apparent. The innermost depth of the psyche is in complete touch with this functioning of pure mind. Now, pure mind is quite free of any conditioning. pure mind is absolute. The laws of the spirit are absolute. And pure mind knows those laws. Knows not in our sense of the word know. A seeing subject looking at an observed object and knowing that this is so and so. Not in that sense, but knowing by being. Pure mind itself, the laws of the spirit are the stuff of pure mind. This energy will function that way. If it is absolute, obviously it cannot be stated in words. And yet, there are words which will bear relationship to the mode of that functioning. And those words are the same words as represent our ordinary moralities. The commandments, the precepts, the advices, use whichever word you like, which are found in all the religions. But with this difference, that whereas in our worldly sphere and in the psychical sphere, which lies within the realm of duality very largely, there is the ambivalent expression of these moralities. Thou shalt do no hurt. All right, what is the meaning of doing no hurt? In different lands, people have different ideas about hurting or not hurting, and different practices. And in any one land, different people have also had different ideas and different expressions of doing no hurt. Now, if you take this alone as one example, thou shalt do no hurt, it has its transcendent counterpart. And it is that transcendent counterpart, which is the law, the absolute law of the spirit, which pure mind knows. And in the knowing, it fulfills continuously, without let or hindrance. Now perhaps we can sense the meaning, the real meaning of what is commonly called the moral imperative. Where does it come from? How does it happen? This power of pure mind is perpetually affecting the psyche, but it is affecting it non-compulsorily. This is the strange part of it. What functions in eternity is eternally patient. It never compels. But in this thing which we call time, its manifestation comes into being. This is the meaning of the living process, the growth process. The ripeness shows itself. When the ripeness shows itself, we see it in time. But for eternity, there is no time in that ripeness. It's an extraordinary thing. It's a wonderful thing. You know, even if the intellect alone can penetrate into this, it brings a remarkable sense of freedom and sheer joy, a peaceful joy that one is alive and can see truth, or at least something of the truth. So now, whereas the moralities in the ordinary way function in the realm of duality, the transcendent commands of pure mind function in the realm of eternity. Whereas morality in the realm of duality entails struggle, entails conflict. I want to do this, but morality says, no, thou shalt not. So there's a conflict. In the realm of pure mind, there is no conflict whatsoever. Now, both elements are in the psyche. Every single impression which comes to us or which arises from within us means such and such forces which inevitably must work out. Punna bhava, again becoming. See? So this is how the pattern of our life emerges, and it is all within us, all the time. All of it is within us. Within the actual living physical body. Try and really feel this carefully. So now you see, on the one hand, we have to talk in dualistic terms. On the one hand, there is this absolute, omnipotent power, which is quite untroubled with any questions of right or wrong, good or bad, success or failure, fulfillment or frustration or anything. The transcendent has no such problems. That transcendent is functioning on the one hand, and here, dualistically, the conflict of the duals is also functioning simultaneously. You and I have the power to say yea or nay to the process as a whole. Now, this saying yea or nay does not mean that, I shall take sides with the transcendent and that will be lovely. It won't. You can't take sides with the transcendent. The transcendent doesn't have it. It won't have it. It says, go on, clean that house out first. The house of duality. So, how then does karma work itself out, if we are really concerned with it and are intelligent about it? We must beware above all imposing our desire upon it, because that will make the situation worse and worse all the time. If we practice mindfulness with the ulterior motive of, I must clean this house out, become free, and then my Lord God will come and have a lovely time. No, it will never happen that way. But if mindfulness is truly desireless, a desireless mindfulness all the time, then one is right out of the realm of duality, out of the realm of conflict, or the possibility of conflict. One is out of that realm because through desirelessness, one is free from self-orientation. Look into this very carefully. Desirelessness means one is wholly free of self-orientation, of selfness, of the egoism which spoils true egohood. If you understand this, you will understand why particularly Hinduism and Buddhism have laid supreme emphasis upon desirelessness. And an absolute desirelessness. There is no such thing where totality is concerned, where transcendence is concerned, as good desires and bad desires. That lies in the realm of duality, conflict. There are no comparatives or superlatives in transcendence. Good desires never become better where transcendence is concerned. Bad desires never become worse. Or, other way around, bad desires become good and good become bad. There's none of all that where transcendence is concerned. The sense of wholeness, of totality, and the release of harmony means holiness in the real sense. So you see, desirelessness in the complete sense is fundamentally important for the religious life. I don't think that the ordinary religious presentations in either Hinduism or Buddhism have really explained this properly. I haven't come across any. But one has to see this very, very clearly. Transcendence itself is desireless. Free of dualities, free of conflicts, there is no such thing as self-orientation where the totality is concerned. There cannot be, even with ordinary intellectual logic. There cannot be. So you see, when there is this freedom from self-orientation, you are in rhythm with that universal life-death rhythm, which is continuous creation, the manifestation of creative power. This is action in the real sense. And this is the real meaning of karma. So get quite free of all this seesaw equilibration business where karma is concerned. And many other illusions will disappear when one is clear about what karma really means. Now, in the psyche then, as we are at present, there are all these forces which, in their working out from moment to moment, release the pattern of our daily life. Those of us who are so inclined, who are so stimulated by whatever the circumstance or reason may be, naturally long for liberation, for fulfillment in the religious sense. Now, what is it that is liberated? Obviously, that which is in bondage. I mean, otherwise liberation has no meaning. What is in bondage? The psyche. Liberation concerns the psyche alone. Liberation does not mean that because I have lived the good life, the pure life, the religious life, seen wonderful visions and all the rest of it, therefore my physical circumstances, my problems in the world and so forth will vanish away. You've all heard about this awful cyclone which has struck Orissa. 5 million people, just like that. It can happen to us. Lightning may suddenly strike this house. Some of us may be instantaneously dead and others maimed for life or something, or just left driveling idiots by that stroke of lightning. Nothing of that can be avoided. Do not say that is my karma. That is a hopelessly childish, naive way of looking at it. It happened. in the universal process. There is no liberation from that sort of thing in life. If the IRA were to suddenly place a bomb in a certain part, it is not your karma that you got caught in it. It just happened that way. Life does not function in terms of our human shopkeeping concepts of justice. There is no such justice in the universal process at all. Because our minds are conditioned by our culture to feel that if you invite me to dinner, I must invite you in return some other time. Nice little equilibration. We had dinner at a Chinese restaurant, which of course is exploitively expensive, quite unnecessarily, and £5 was paid by my host, therefore I ought to treat him to dinner, which will be worth more or less £5. Don't you see what absurd creatures we humans are in our everyday life? Now, be free of all that. There is no liberation involved in all that external part of our life. Liberation lies only within the psyche. And that liberation is nothing else than the utter purification of the psyche. And the purification of the psyche means that the psyche shall live in fullness, in poise, in peace, in inward harmony, whatsoever may be the influences that come to disturb us or to please us. Pleasing influences are just as disturbing as displeasing influences in the transcendent sense. Now, this purification of the psyche lies at the very heart of the living of the religious life, of the fulfillment of the moralities. What happens now when one sees this and lives this way? The dualistical expression of our moralities in everyday life is infused with the absoluteness of transcendence, the power of pure mind. This is the irresistible drawing power of God, of the divine, of perfection, of that which eternally is. This is how it works. We become aware of it in terms of time, until in the realization the domination of time is out. The domination of time is out for one's own awareness and for one's own purified psyche. But time is there, a reality for the body, of course, always. And for the functioning of the senses. Sight, sound, and all the rest of it function in terms of time. But when one is so purified, so liberated, one has worked out one's karma, as we say, then you will find that you are aware of time in a very different way. Remember, life, death is really life, other life, life, other life rhythm. Similarly with time, eternity. There is no such thing as eternity minus time, nor time without eternity. Eternity rides on the wings of time. And when there is liberation from within, you will be aware in this way. Which means that the awareness of totality will shine through each and every single discrete event, state of consciousness, whatever the thing may be. Totality manifests through every limited, finite thing. That's the marvel of it all. And this is the liberated state. The liberated one is like that. Understand this, and better still, experience it and live it. And you will then completely understand why there have been statements like this, that to the yogi, to the truly holy one, a stone, a Brahman, a cow, God, are all the same. But now, this collection of living forces within the psyche, which is constantly trying to work itself out, is a collection of forces which holds a vast burden of unnecessary sorrow and suffering, and of continued sorrow and suffering. What do we do about it? We are conscious of part of this sorrow and suffering. And we are foolish enough to desire and bend our efforts to change it into a preconceived form which is we think is a form of happiness. This is false. No preconception of happiness on my part is anywhere near the reality or truth of happiness. What is one of the great forces which enables this accumulation of unnecessary sorrow and suffering, and the sources of sorrow and suffering to accumulate inside me? My grasping at this, that, or the other. Now look at the moralities. Thou shalt do no hurt whatsoever. That's the transcendent, absolute commandment. And the second absolute commandment, which is the transcendent counterpart of the ordinary moralities, which states, thou shalt not take what is not freely given unto thee. Thou shalt grasp at nothing whatsoever in the universe. What is the implication of grasping at something? Isolative self-consciousness. If I do not separate myself from the totality, I will never want to grasp at anything in the totality. Because totality and I are one. I am inseparably one with totality. And if that is the case, I don't grasp at it, at anything in it. I think I've said this before. I don't try to grasp at my nose. It's very easy to grasp it because it's so big. You see? I don't grasp at it because it is there. There is no sense of separation between my natural, organic body consciousness and a part of the body, the nose. I don't grasp at it. But we are not aware of the whole universe in that way. When we are aware of, or grow in awareness in such a manner that it becomes second nature to feel the universe rather than to feel I and you and that and it and all the rest of it, then you don't grasp at anything at all. There is the transcendent fulfillment of the absolute law. Thou shalt not grasp at anything whatsoever. And I'll just mention a third. The absolute commandment. Thou shalt not self-indulge. Here again, the implication of self-indulgence is that I am a separate self. This is the fundamental state of sin. I separated from this, that, or the other. If one is free of all self-indulgence, then that which is the self in the ordinary common and garden sense, which is perfectly true for all practical purposes, this self is the very thing through which the totality will shine, unhindered. And then this self will be rightly used all the time, everywhere. It won't be misused. You know this phrase which we have in the language, we have it in all the languages of the world, the abuse of the self. Do we not all, have we not all sometime or other abused ourselves? And if you look at that abuse, you will see that it is completely tied up with the passion for self-indulgence. When self-indulgence is truly out, there is natural and right self-use, self-utility. This is used in the right way. Now don't get caught in the trap. Do remember that you cannot carry this out deliberately by intellectual predetermination. This is the right use of the self and I'll do it. Because you'll find, if you can look deeply enough, with such intellectual predetermination, there is always tied up the desire for self to gain some good result. This we must be free of. If you meet God, say, "Hello, Lord," and let him pass by. Don't catch him by the sleeve in order to get something out of him. Just let him pass by. Or if you're busy, you pass by. He knows his way. But you see, the psyche, the soul of man, the mind of man is so subtle, so complex, so difficult to penetrate, isn't it? So difficult to understand. But look, observe, with desireless mindfulness, it's a tremendous thing. And when there is desireless mindfulness, all the verbal formulation which is associated with the practice of mindfulness, it may be there, but it will no longer obstruct the mindfulness, no longer make you mistake the verbal formulation for the actual thing. You will be mindful of the actual thing and not the words which you have used to describe the actual thing. See, our greatest instrument of salvation, which is in every living organism, is our power of attention. To what shall we give our attention? Again, can we give it deliberately? No. If we attempt to give it deliberately, there will always be the self, the separated self involved in it. You can give your attention, I'll put it the other way, your attention will get given inevitably if there is love. We have all been in love sometime or other somewhere. And then, how difficult it was to get the beloved or the object of love out of our minds. We couldn't help but give attention all the time. It was impossible to be free of giving attention. It just went there. Isn't it said in the New Testament, wheresoever thy treasure is, there thy heart will be? Is the transcendent your treasure? The beloved? The impossible to avoid beloved? The beloved who is loved out of complete blindness, deafness, dumbness? Then it is love. Because whatsoever comes from the beloved then will be absorbed by you, wholly absorbed. And in that absorbing, there will be a magical process of transmutation going on. The stuff of the psyche will change. And to such an extent that it will also change the stuff of the body. Have you met a real life holy man or woman and looked at him? What is there about that person? What is there that draws you? That seems to spread a healing influence, a calming influence. That seems to make you breathe so easily. What is there? The transfiguration of the person. A holy man is a transfigured being. You see, that holiness comes out of love, out of the total attention which he gives to what? To totality. To the whole. For him there is no problem of a conflict between acceptance and rejection. Being in complete tune with the whole reality, he knows that there is perpetual transformation going on. There is no need to take sides with one against another, under the excuse of improving the bad and making it good. These are very deep things, really. But they are very wonderful things. Don't just think about them. If you start thinking about what you hear, and which at the first hearing you may understand, you may not understand, you may take to, or you may feel repelled by, if you merely think about it, you will produce turmoil and conflict. Don't think about it. Just let it be. Keep the mind open, peaceful, and then love will arise. And in that state of love, understanding will grow. And what is commonly called all evil karma will get transmuted into good. Because this karma is part of the stuff of the psyche. You can't get rid of it. You can't throw it out. If you have some trouble with your finger, you don't immediately cut it off and throw it out. You're less by a finger forever if you do that. But you heal it. And the healing process of the psyche is a transmutation process. And that psychical energy, which was cramped and distorted, is now good stuff, so to say. Just good in itself, whole and healthy. And that means liberation in the real sense. So as I say, love emerges. You know how it is in life? Two friends, or man and wife, or whatever the relationship may be, brothers or sisters, or whatever the relationship may be, or two people who are enemies. You live together, and you keep on living together, and you will find slowly this extraordinary spiritual alchemy taking place. That which was so distasteful, so terrible to endure, somehow you stop taking sides with yourself and demanding reciprocally that the other shall behave unto you as you, as you imagine you are behaving nicely and lovingly to the other. You will cease to demand. When you cease to demand, then this wonderful absorptive power is at work. And when you absorb that other without taking sides, the situation becomes transformed. That other may never change, may become worse in fact, may become more troublesome. But it is you who get liberated. And in that liberating, there is an extraordinary transformation going on in the other also, unbeknown to himself or herself. One must never try to change another deliberately. This is a tremendous mistake. If I try to change somebody else for the better, first and foremost, I am immediately guilty of extraordinary conceit. I know. Do I? I mention this merely because it is part of the karmic process in most people's lives. This sort of thing gets involved. Human relationships are perpetually with us. We are not lone inhabitants of desert isles. We are always with others. And so this problem of human relationships comes up. One of the great influences which determines karma. So understand karma itself to start with. Try and get free of the illusions, and then see what happens. If you like, spend 5 minutes very quietly, just looking into the karmic elements, the forces that are within one's own psyche. And the simplest ones to look at are the ones which are what we commonly call problems. See, they may be problems of human relationship. Problems because of the frustrations we have suffered in life through love, ambition, business, etc., etc., whatever it may be. You see, just let us spend a few minutes looking quietly into that. Take any one thing and just watch it. Just watch it. If one watches in stillness and silence, the rhythm of life completely suffuses one and brings that state of peace and harmony within one's whole being, which enables true understanding to emerge. The true understanding which transcends the limitations of all particular forms of thought and all speech.